worship guides and pull out your outlines and say, "'Tis just a flesh wound." Now, you know, the plague that we're studying today are open, oozing boils. And so normally when I'm preparing the worship guide, I always put a picture of whatever the plague is on the front. But I was nauseated looking up those pictures. And so I opted for a Monty Python approach to our worship guide. If you don't get that, it really doesn't matter. But just thought there's no way I can put an open boil on the front of a worship guide and get away with that. That is too gross, too disgusting. So Monty Python it is. Those of you that know who the Black Knight is, there you go. You've got him on the front. Whoever thought you would see that at church? So, you know, we've been in the plagues, and so if you've got your Bibles, you should open them up to Exodus chapter 9. We're going to be launching off right around verse 8. And if you don't have a Bible with you, there should be one nearby in one of the book racks. And so grab that and open it up to the second book of the Bible, the 9th chapter and the 8th verse. Exodus chapter 9, verse 8. Of course, the nation of Egypt is recovering as we pick up the narrative in verse 8. They're recovering from the loss, number one, letter A, of a significant number of livestock from the previous plague, plague number 5 that precedes this one. All that story is detailed there in Exodus 9, 1 through 7. God, immediately following that plague, sends Moses and Aaron to strike at Pharaoh in Egypt with another devastating plague. We find it in verse 8. Then the Lord, Yahweh, said to Moses and Aaron, "Take for yourselves handfuls of soot from a kiln or kiln dust, and let Moses throw it toward the sky in the sight of Pharaoh." Now just figuratively, who lives in the sky? God lives in the sky. And so he's calling on Moses and Aaron to go take a handful of soot out of the kiln and throw it up into the sight of God, and to do so while being in the sight of Pharaoh. This plague, letter B, is number 6 in the 10 plagues against Egypt, and it comes without warning. Remember, in previous plagues, there's a pattern that we've got here, and so the third, the sixth, and the ninth plague all come without any kind of warning, and they, in some capacity, they kind of parallel one another, much like the plague of the gnats, which also came from dust, you'll recall, and it marks the end of the second cycle of plagues, numbers 4 through 6. We are about to launch into the last significant cycle of plagues, which are significant. Hail, locusts, and darkness, and those plagues are going to be global and devastating and really off the charts. But like the plague of gnats from dust, this plague is from kiln dust or soot that comes from the kiln. Now, if you'll recall, the Hebrews were in slavery to the Egyptians. In fact, that's still the state that they find themselves in. They're being freed from that slavery. But do you remember what their job was as slaves in Egypt? They made bricks, right? They made bricks for storehouses and that kind of thing that would surround the cities where the kings or the pharaohs resided. Around their palaces. We've been advertising the archaeological lecture that occurred at Biola this past week, and I got to see they've unearthed these storehouses, massive. The palace would sit in the center of a complex, and all around them, and it just went out for a very, very long way, were these storehouses, archways and storehouses, all made out of bricks, some of them still standing, even to this day, that the Israelites built while they were in Egypt. It's fascinating stuff. The Israelites were in charge of making all of these bricks, of providing these bricks to other Israelites, which were the workers. And so there's a real sense, letter C, of justification that exists in this In just this oppression of Egypt that occurs in this judgment, Israel suffered many long hours of baking bricks and kilns under their taskmasters, or under those people that lorded it over them and actually beat them and persecuted them. Now the remnants of that persecution, the dust, the soot that comes from that kiln, is going to be the object of Egypt's, or this object of Egypt's oppression, are thrown to God, and God returns it back down on Egypt in judgment. The boils that are spoken of, and take a look at verse 9, Exodus 9, verse 9. This dust that is thrown up into the sky, it will become fine dust all over the land of Egypt, and it will become boils, breaking out with sores on man and beast through all the land. The boils that these caused on people's and animals' skin were so intense. They were so big, and they were so pregnant that they burst open into sores. I know this is disgusting. I see some of you making faces at me right now. Take a look at how it's phrased in verse 9. This fine dust over the land of Egypt will become boils. Now that's bad enough. If you've ever had a boil, or anything like that, a skin infection, that's extremely painful. Boils breaking out with sores. The boils were so intense that they burst open. So what you have here is a picture of open, oozing sores on people's bodies, on their faces, on their bodies, and it's on their cattle. It's all over the place. The word picture is disgusting. And it covered both the bodies of man and beast in Egypt. This is pretty serious stuff. Now take a look at the top of the next page of your outline. Of all the plagues that have occurred in Egypt up to this point, this is the first plague where the actual lives of the Egyptians were shown to be in actual real danger. This is the first plague that it would have occurred to them, okay, this is going increasingly bad for us. This is now, like, I can look at my skin, I can look at the looks of people when they're like, ooh, that thing on your forehead, not looking very good. When people are around me and I've got open wounds on my face and that kind of thing, this is the first time that God's hand has touched the actual Egyptians, and it is causing them real, real pain. They, for the very first time, are realizing that their very lives are in the hands of God. It marks a change in how God is dealing with Egypt. He is now pouring out his wrath on the people. Their lives are not their own. They would have understood that quite clearly. Suddenly, these lives that they felt like were safe in Egypt, that were protected by the gods of Egypt, that were protected by the magicians in Egypt, they suddenly would connect with, whoa, our lives are not safe. Look what's happening to our cattle. Look what's happening to us. Things are falling apart in the land. As becomes increasingly clear through the progression of the plagues, this plague strikes also at the theological foundations of Egypt's religious systems. The Egyptian gods of Sekhmet, that was the goddess of power. She's a goddess. You actually would recognize her if I put her up on the screen. She's got a golden sundial on her head. She looks kind of like a dog. That's probably not a popular look for us these days, but she was very, very popular and a very powerful goddess. And Imhotep, you might have heard Imhotep's name before. It's an easy to say name in English, and so it's used in the movies quite a bit. If you've seen any of the Mummy movies, Imhotep is one of the gods that's running around in that, and he was the god of health and peace. Unlike the movies, he's the god of health. And he's the god of peace, and he is one of those unusual characters that was actually a human being. He was actually a guy that lived in Egypt and knew a whole lot about physician and healing people, and they deified him after his death, and he ascended into being one of the most prominent gods that existed in Egypt. These gods, which would have been well known to any Egyptian, they're all over the sarcophagus hieroglyphs that we find throughout Egypt. They're in any book that you've probably looked at pictures of these two gods before, and you didn't realize that that's what their names were. They were powerfully subdued. Like, this would have been common to the mind of the average Egyptian, and these gods were being powerfully subdued by the Lord God, Yahweh, of the Hebrews in this epidemic plague of boils and open sores. So intense is this plague that it even attacks the magicians, it even attacks the heads of state that exist in Egypt. The total impotence, letter C, of Egypt's gods are illustrated with oozing significance when Egypt's own magicians can't stand before Moses due to their unclean wounds. Let's pick it up again in verse 10. So they took soot, this is Moses from a kiln, stood before Pharaoh, and Moses threw it towards the sky, throws it to God, and it became boils, breaking out with sores on man and beast. The magicians could not stand before Moses because of the boils, for the boils were on the magicians as well as on all of the Egyptians. On those people that had wisdom, those people that were well known for being ritually clean. If you have ever studied the Egyptian way of life, one of the things that they understood was that if you were sick physically, or if you had sores that were on the outside of your body, it was because the gods had betrayed you. The gods were angry with you. You had done something to make the gods angry. And we even have a little bit of that notion today, don't we? You know, like when things go really right for somebody, we're like, oh, you must be living right. And when things go really bad for somebody, you know, it's like, what did you do to tick God off? Because your life is just going right down the tubes right now. We always joke when I get to go golfing with Gary, whenever he hits a bad shot, I'm like, oh, what did you do? You know, you're not living right with Jesus and that kind of thing. And Gary gets to say that to me a lot because I hit a lot more errant shots than he does. So, we joke about these things, even in our common vernacular. Well, in Egypt, this was true. This wasn't just some kind of like, you know, oh, bad karma kind of thing. They really genuinely believed that this existed, that when they broke out in sores or when they had problems physically, that it was a response from the gods to them. It was an attack of the gods on them. The reality is that as God spreads these boils out on the Egyptian people, it is a judgment. It is a judgment for what they have been doing to his people. It's a judgment that comes from the soot that is out of the kilns, which was a representation of their oppression. And so it's got a lot of meaning. It's got a lot of layers to it. It would have been meaningful to the Israelites. There would have been a deep sense of justification in that. But the reality is the boils on the outside of the Egyptians were a physical manifestation or a physical sign of their inward reality. They were sick and rotting on the inside, and God was bringing what was on the inside of Egypt's spiritual, theological reality. He was bringing it to the outside of the people, and he was showing them the death that was involved. They could see it in their own bodies. They could see it in their spiritual leaders. All of them were covered with these boils and with these wounds. Imagine, most of you took time this morning, did you not, to get ready for church? I know I do. I don't shave at all on Saturdays. If you see me on Saturday nights, I'm a bit of a hairy beast. I know that's hard to believe, but when I don't shave, I get all kind of scratchy and my head looks kind of, you know, starts to grow only on the sides, the top quite bald, but on the sides it kind of, you know, looks silly. I've got a little donut on my head and this kind of thing. And so when I wake up on Sunday morning, I'm a mess. And it takes me a good 30 minutes in the morning to weed whack all that down and shave it all off and shine the dome and be ready for church, all right? I put on the clothing that I take to the dry cleaner on Sundays, generally the only day of the week that I'm not in blue jeans and sandals or shorts and sandals and that kind of thing. And so I dress up for church. Now, I know some of you think, he looks like he's dressed down for church, you know, because I'm accustomed to people wearing ties and stuff like that. But I actually dress up for church. This is as good as it's going to get. So I know a lot of you do the same kind of thing. It's like a social norm where we live that you kind of dress, you know, decently for church. You don't look like a fool. And you generally spend a little bit of time on a Sunday morning getting ready. Now, we live in a very casual corner of the nation, and so we don't go to town like some places do to really dress to the nines. But most of us spent some time this morning in front of a mirror, looking back and trying to make what stares back at you acceptable enough to go into public, right? And so we understand the concept of what it means to dress up. Now, imagine if you could not hide your spiritual condition in the way that you looked. Imagine that the spiritual condition of your heart began to manifest itself on the outside of your body. Like, if you weren't walking with God, if you were steeped in some kind of sin that you were struggling with, boom, big giant boil breaks out right on your forehead. Wouldn't matter how much cover up you put on that thing, everybody would see big, swollen, sore, oozing on forehead. You got mad at your wife last night, you went to bed angry, boom, you got sores all over your hands. You've been having trouble at work and you're having, you know, just really struggling with some issue. Maybe it's anger, maybe it's jealousy, maybe it's, you know, you didn't get the promotion and so now you're torpedoing somebody else's job. Boom, you've got sores all over you. Your spiritual condition, your internal condition, the condition of your heart in front of the Lord is suddenly being manifest on the outside. Do you think it would change the way? Do you think it would change the way that you dealt with your sin? See, for all of us here, we can just get dressed up nice. We can just look good and somebody walks up to us and says, "How you doing?" And all we've got to say is, "I'm good. All's great." You just got to flash a smile, shake a hand, be nice, give a hug. We're good. I mean, some of you have to suffer through the greeting time. You know, it's a little bit like, oh, what am I going to do? I got to really go into high power hiding right now. But you can do it. You can come to this church and you can fake us all out. And you know why? Because God doesn't make you break out in boils when you've got sin in your life. But imagine if we could all see the reality of your heart on the outside of your person, what would you look like right now? What would you look like? Would you have a broken arm? Would we walk up to you and your arm would be like, whoop, bink? And we'd be like, oh, what's going on? Nothing, I'm good. No, you're not. Have you seen your arm? You got big, open, oozing wounds on your face? How you doing? Totally fine. Things are going so well. I'm loving life. You look horrible. You need something for your face. Like a bag. I mean, you got issues. What's going on? Tell me the truth. What you've told me and what I see are not the same. I wonder if it would change you. I wonder if your spiritual condition could be seen on the outside, if it would change who you are, would it cause you to take the inside as seriously as you do the outside? Would you spend as much time on the interior of your heart as you do on the exterior of your body? Dressing nicely, slapping on deodorant, shooting the perfume or the cologne on, shaving your head if you're like me, or quaffing your dew if you're like you. Whatever it is, would you take that kind of time to make sure that the interior of your life is settled? Because I tell you that Jesus Christ was concerned with these things, and that's why we come to a communion table. Because Jesus Christ didn't want us to forget Him. He didn't want us to forget what was most important in our lives, which is not what you can see. It's not what's on the outside. It's the heart of the person. And so Jesus Christ invites us to experience the bread and to experience the wine and to do so in a way that literally is in remembrance of Him. To carefully consider the interior of your own life in light of Jesus, in light of the cross of Jesus Christ. The Egyptians were forced to deal with their spiritual realities. Could they rely on Sekhmet? Could they rely on Imhotep? No. They suddenly realized that they were the objects of wrath in the hands of an angry God. And the physical manifestations that they saw on the outside of themselves were the outward expression of what was really going on in their hearts. Hearts that were not given to God, hearts that were oppressing God's people. This is a society that exalted ritual cleanliness, that exalted pure skin, that exalted perfect looks. I can't go into it because it would take too long, but the priests in Egypt spent literally hours a day plucking the hair that was on their bodies out so that it wouldn't grow back out. Now, I'm big into not having hair, but I mean, that's over the top, all right? They were highly focused on what they saw on the outside, not unlike the world that you and I live in. Highly focused, and suddenly, all that they could see was open, oozing, disgusting sores. It's almost shocking when you come down to after verse 11, when you see that even the magicians could not stand before Moses. They would not be seen with boils on themselves. It was a total admission of their weakness and their impotence. And you come down to verse 12, and it says that Pharaoh's heart was hardened, and he did not listen to them, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. But something's different here. Something is different than all the other plagues up to this point. Look at verse 12. And the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, or made Pharaoh's heart strong against God. The Lord did this to him. Up to now, Pharaoh has hardened his own heart, or it's just gone without comment. But this is the first time that we've seen that the Lord hardens Pharaoh's heart. And because God had done this, Pharaoh hardens his heart. He would not listen to them, just as the Lord had promised, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. Number 3, letter A. As with previous plagues, the heart of Pharaoh is hardened toward God. Pharaoh refuses to let God's people go to worship the Lord. However, letter B, for the first time, God is the agent of hardening Pharaoh's heart. Pharaoh does not harden his own heart. God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Could Pharaoh have said, yeah, I'll let the people go in the face of this plague? It's unimportant. The text doesn't even address it. You can go back and you can say, oh, but look at how many times Pharaoh hardens his own heart. And you'll look forward and you'll see Pharaoh harden his own heart again. What matters here is that Pharaoh's heart was hardened and that God was the agent. It's a sovereign, meaning God is king, God is in control, and judicial, it's a judgment, act of God. It leaves Pharaoh in rebellion against God. And it's not the only time that we see it in Scripture. I list several passages right there. 2 Samuel 17:14 is the story of Absalom and the hardening of his heart. 1 Kings 12:15 is when Jeroboam comes to Rehoboam and says, will you lighten the load? And Rehoboam listens to his younger counselor friends, and it says God hardens his heart. And so Rehoboam's heart was hardened. Deuteronomy 2:30, Moses is working his way around the land, and someone called Sihon, the king of Heshbon, has his heart hardened so that Moses will attack them and kill them. And finally, the kings of the hill country against Joshua in Joshua 11:20. It says that Joshua fought against those kings for a very long time. But God purposely hardens the hearts of those kings so that Joshua will go up there and conquer the land. So that he will go and conquer the high country. It's not the only time that we see God acting in this manner, where God hardens the heart of an enemy or God hardens the heart of a man so that he will go and run himself into a foolish situation. This change, letter C, in how God is dealing with Pharaoh in Egypt is a powerful reminder of what God has been teaching his people all along and what God is even teaching us this morning. Simply, God is in control. No matter what or how things appear, God is the one that is in control. God is in sovereign, judicial, authoritative, complete control of what is going on. When we look at a situation, whether it's something simple, like is in our own family, or something national, like is going on with the United States, or something global that is occurring in Libya or elsewhere, God is in control. God is the God of all of it. Not just a part of it, not just your heart, not just our heart, but all things. God clearly is in control. God chooses to not show mercy to Egypt. And it's a terrible sign of what is in store for Egypt, what Egypt's future holds for them. Now, this should drive some questions for you. And I've tried to include a few questions down there at the bottom. Is the hardening of Pharaoh's heart consistent with the character of God as you know it? Like, you should be asking yourself that question. Does God harden my heart? Great question. You should explore that. Who is the God that you worship? Does he do that to you? Does he do that to us? Is it the prerogative of God to deal with mankind in whatever way he wishes? Can he bless some and curse others? And is that okay? Is it okay for God to do that? I mean, look at the choice God is making. Who's he siding with here? The Jews. Who's he siding against? The Egyptians. Does that strike you as being racist? To choose one over the other? What if you did that? What if you decided, well, I'm gonna favor white people over black people? What would you call that? Racism is what you would call that. Does that strike you as being consistent with the character of God? Man, I've really got your attention. Nobody's looking down right now. This is great. I don't always have this kind of attention. Can God cause calamity for man or mankind if he so desires? And by calamity, I mean horrible events. Events that take lives. Events that cause pain. Is God responsible to provide mercy and grace for people? That's certainly the God that you are probably most familiar with, right? The God that extends mercy. The God that extends grace. The God that extends love. For God so loved the world, not condemned the world. Jesus Christ did not come into the world to condemn the world. That's the next verse, John 3:17. Is God responsible to provide mercy and grace? If God can save, does he have to? Is God under some kind of moral imperative to save people? Can he choose to save my wife, but not me? A lot of you are in relationships where the person you're married to doesn't know Jesus. Is it just for God to save one and not the other? Is trusting God safe? I mean, we paint it out to be, don't we? The best place you can be is in the hands of God. Does it sound like it here? All right, these are questions, all right? You get to answer them. You should talk about these things with your spouse, with your Bible study groups. You should dig in. Like, I think the world asks themselves these questions. They look at what God does, and then they ask these kinds of questions. I hear it on the radio. I hear it in things that I read. I hear people all the time say that God is the most racist. He's the most genocidal character in all of history. And that if believing in God means believing in the God that is present there in the Old Testament, I would never do it because that God is out of control, crazy, and just kills people for no good reason. It would strike me that as believers in God, you and I should have some sort of concept of who it is that we are worshiping. What is his character like? What is this actually asking about? Because I'll tell you, I bet you the Egyptians were asking these questions. I bet in the privacy of their own homes, when they were realizing that the gods of Egypt were not cutting it, and they were thinking about the God of the Hebrews, I bet you they were wondering what this God was really like. I bet you in the privacy of Goshen, where the Israelites lived, as they sat down and they contemplated, man, we haven't seen God show up in what seems like many, many generations. And now look at him. Now look at what he's doing. What do you think it's going to be like to have to serve that God? What's it like to have him choose us? He's going to take us away from here, and he's going to take us out into the desert where we're going to serve him. What happens when we tick him off? What happens when things go wrong? What happens if we don't do everything that we're supposed to do for him? Does it look like it's going to go well for them? We as a community are being led by the Lord through these passages so that we can learn these same lessons. And so I want to force some of these questions onto you and ask you not to just be a spectator of the Scriptures, but to engage them, to talk about them, to wrestle with them. Let's make sure that we ourselves are engaging what God calls on His people to engage in the Word. You know, I asked earlier a question which hopefully ferreted some response from your soul, but I asked you a question earlier, if your behavior would change if you suddenly broke out in boils when you sinned. If you struggled with anger and you got sick. If you were looking at porn and you went blind. If you got angry on the freeway and suddenly, I don't know, you had some terrible disease break out on the outside of your skin. Would it change the way that you would behave if there was that connection, that physical ailment that was connected to a spiritual sin that's on the inside of you? Would that change your behavior? Reality is, though, right? The reason I'm asking that question is because we're motivated by what the other people in this room think of us. I'm motivated by what you think of me. If you didn't like something about me, that would bother me. Some of you play that against me occasionally. You know that about me, and so you'll manipulate me with that information, knowing that I'm a bit of a people pleaser. I fight against that. I've got a lot of people that are around me that are not people pleasers, and they tell me to blow you off. So there's a balance to things in the economy of this. But some of you are people pleasers. You understand what I mean. We're motivated oftentimes by what other people think. Maybe not by what everybody thinks. Like, I remember that when I was a teenager, I didn't really care what my parents thought. In fact, I wanted to tick them off. That made me kind of happy if I knew I could get underneath their skin. It's not a universal, but we all care about something. Like when I was a teenager, I really cared about what my friends thought. Like if I would have been rejected by all of my friends, that would have been suicide. That would have been devastating to me. So I don't know what group it is that you care about what that person thinks, but I know it exists for all of us. Oftentimes we care about what other people think of us at work. We care about what our friends think about us. Some of you are obsessed with school and you care about what your teachers think about the job that you're doing. All these kinds of things. It ferrets out that simply we all on some level feel a little bit of social pressure to appear right, look right, act right, be right on the outside. But I don't want, as we head towards communion, I don't want the reality of what is true in Scripture to escape anybody that is here. And it's this. That when God looks at you, the Bible says He does not look on the outside. He looks at your heart. So God sees you as you really are. Boils and all. God sees you in your true spiritual condition. And you've heard me say it before, and you'll hear me say it again. As believers in Jesus Christ, we ought to be living to an audience of one. Not so concerned about impressing one another, but most concerned about impressing God. Most concerned about what he thinks, about our relationship to him, about the cross of Jesus Christ, about living our lives in remembrance of him, literally living out communion with him in the world, in our everyday lives. The other 29 or 30 days of the month that you don't take communion, most of you, are you living out your communion in those moments? Because God does see what is more important. Truly, I ask that to you as an honest question, not a rhetorical one. What is more important to you? What we see in this room or what God sees in your heart? God is in control. If there's a singular message that exists in these 10 plagues, it's that God is in complete control. You don't have to be in Israel. You don't have to be an Israelite. You don't have to be a follower of Jesus Christ. You don't have to be a Christian for God to be in control. God's in control of all of it. God is clearly in control. He is teaching us through these stories about total dependence on him. And I have to ask, before I turn things over to Scott Wilson, one of our elders, I have to ask you to think and contemplate and process and pray and prepare your heart. If God truly sees the true condition of your heart, what does he see there? What's really going on between you and Jesus today? What's really the condition of your soul in front of God? This morning is an opportunity for you to stop playing games and for you to begin to take Jesus seriously, to remember him in the midst of your life. Right now, today is that opportunity. Jesus Christ calls on us to remember him, to write our lives, to ask him for forgiveness, to make commitments if necessary, to make sure that we are in a good, consistent, honest, authentic walk with him, to live consistently from the inside to the outside. You have nothing to hide from any of us, and there's nothing you can hide from God. Any dressing ourselves up, any looking good for one another, should stop at just being a social nicety. After that, what we need to do is live true, consistently, so that what people experience on the outside of who we are is true of what's on the inside of us. There's only one way to do that. It's not to just be as honest as you can. It's to live to an audience of one. It's to live your life focused, as Paul said, on the cross of Jesus Christ. It's to live in remembrance of him. Imagine if you broke out in boils when you sinned. I got to tell you, I'd be a mess. And the thing I realized as I was studying this was that one of the reasons that I don't take my sin more seriously is because it doesn't manifest itself physically, because I'm so concerned about you all, about my kids, about my wife. And I had to have my own times of honesty with the Lord and just say, I need to be more concerned about what you think than what anybody else thinks. So I'm preaching to a mirror today, as I often do. But as I come to this table this morning, I'm coming with my commitments to the Lord. I'm coming with my confession to the Lord. And I'm coming with the heart that says, I want to follow you more than anything. Will you consider these same things as you respond to the Lord this morning, as we prepare ourselves, as you prepare yourself for this communion time.